A talk on Elder Joseph and an exhortation to humility delivered at the Holy Monastery of Philotheo. In this talk, my fathers, I will speak briefly about the life of my saintly elder. His whole life is a living lesson in spiritual struggle. He often told us that an obedient disciple who brings peace to his elder will also be pleasing to God. When I heard this counsel of the elder, I set it as my aim, in my obedience and in my life beside him, to apply this fatherly counsel with all the strength of my soul. Night and day I thought of nothing else but how to give him rest, not with words but with deeds, with the lived experience of my life. When the time drew near for the elder to depart from this life for the other, the Blessed One, very timidly I spoke to him, for this had been my longing, and there at the very end it was as if I needed to set my soul at rest, to know for certain whether my life had been pleasing to the elder. Perfectly pleasing to the elder. I had always hesitated to ask him questions about his inner spiritual life, his private life, if I may put it that way, because I had such deep respect for him. But this time, since he was about to leave, I found the courage to ask him. I said to him, "Elder, will I have given you rest?" He answered me and said, "As you have given me rest, may God give you rest. And when the time comes for you to fall asleep, to depart from this life, if I find boldness before God, I will come beforehand, at the hour of your death, to assure you and to stand beside you." For me, of course, these words he spoke were like a great gift. I believed then, and I firmly believe now, that he found much boldness before God, because I knew his life up close, that it was exceedingly holy. There was a brotherhood, a bond of spiritual friendship with the elder, with Elder Arsenios. They would visit the elder and consult him on various matters. One of the fathers, and indeed the youngest in that brotherhood, by the name of Oionikios, was a grace-filled child, young and strong in body, but in soul too he was not behind. Through the contact the whole brotherhood had with the elder, he as well attached himself to the elder, and consulted him mainly about prayer. The elder told him a good many things, and he made a very good beginning, and the prayer began to do its work within him. The prayer began to be said with ease. He began to feel that spiritual warmth of the prayer, and much liveliness. And for this reason he gave himself over wholly to attaining those things which John advised him to pursue. Now it was, of course, the will of God that this monk should depart from life very early, and he fell ill with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis in that time was what cancer is today. Medical science was unable to offer any effective help. Once the fathers agreed, the matter was settled. They left him in God's hands and began preparing him for the next world. He saw that the brotherhood had placed him apart in a small cell with its own door leading outside the building. They brought his food to him there, and had set aside separate belongings and utensils for him, so that the others would not become infected. Every day he would go up to the elder, who lived on an upper floor, and they would discuss many things. In this way, the elder gave him spiritual comfort for the struggle of death, the passage through the toll houses, and so forth. They spoke at length about what was coming, for which he was preparing his soul. His appetite had been cut off entirely. The elder had given him only little bits, a small cup, and the like. And so on, and have a little water. When he became weak, and I felt that he would no longer be able to climb the hill, because of course his condition was gradually draining his strength, he would not be able to do it, and indeed he could not. And the elder said, "My child, do not be troubled. I will come down at night with my prayer rope. As I pray with my prayer rope, I will come down to see you, and then I myself will climb back up." And that is what happened. The elder would come down to him. The elder saw that in just a few days the man's life would come to an end. He said to him, "My child, perhaps one day, as you are climbing up here, you may depart this life before me. When the angel comes to take you, tell him to bring you past me, so that you can bid me farewell, and then go on toward heaven. May it be blessed." A few days later, the elder was sitting there doing his handiwork. That very day, he even told the brotherhood, "Please, as soon as Oionikios departs this life, ring the little bell so that I can hear it up above as well." "Very well," we said. And one day, while the elder was working at the little oxen, and Elder Arsenios was outside cutting as well, the elder suddenly sensed spiritually that Oionikios was there, bidding him farewell. he said, Arsenios, Eunikios is here at this very moment. He is departing. And just as he said this to Elder Arsenios, the little bell began to ring. Such was his obedience, although my own elder was not his elder, because he had helped him greatly in the spiritual life, he regarded him as a spiritual father. The elder's life, or rather his whole life, was one continuous spiritual weeping. Not only did he always weep at night, but often during the day as well, while he was working at what we called the little oxen, I would see him overcome with weeping and tears. There was one occasion when I came out of my hut earlier, because I could not keep the same hours as the elder. I did not have his strength. He remained hidden in his cell, immersed in the beautiful Jesus prayer and in Theoria, the contemplation of God. Being the robust man that I was and still am, I could not manage to stay in there all those hours, so I would come out sooner and work my prayer rope, or I would be fighting off sleep and would spring outside, so that sleep would not overcome me and drag me down. I would take little walks there with my prayer rope, and I would draw near to the elder's hut, and for my own benefit, so that I might imitate him. I would pay a little attention, and sometimes I heard him chanting in his own way, with compunction, certain troparia from the tonsure service of the great schema, hymns about death, the fatherly embrace, and many others, and he would end in much weeping. Many times he would come out after 7 or 8 hours, and his face was shining with the grace of God. When I saw him come out, I would go up to him, and on his own, because I always held back and never asked him deeper questions. On his own, he would tell me various things. One day he says to me that once, before you came here, this place here was full of demons. When I first settled here, I met with great demonic opposition. For a whole month during my prayer, I would see before me, like a film at the cinema, demons parading past, various forms of demons passing by. You would see sorcerers with skulls, terrible things, he says. I would try to pray, and they would struggle to terrify me, so that I would leave this place. This happened almost every night, and I said to myself, I will sit here 1 month. If all this does not stop within this month, I will leave and go where Elder Arsenios is, for they had settled apart from us. On the 30th day, this whole affair came to an end. And you, my child, he says, came and found this place already cleared. But you do not know what toil I went through here in order to hold my ground. All the priests, he said, read exorcisms and command the demons to depart into desolate places, and it seems that a great many of them gathered here as well. Who knows, they waged a fierce war against me. Our order was that at sunset the vigil would begin, the daily, all-night vigil. And of course, beforehand we had to sleep 3 or 4 hours. The devil had opened up against him a war of sleep. That is, once he lay down to sleep, after a little while, something would happen in his sleep, a bang, some frightening thing, and it would wake him. And once the doctor woke, he could no longer get back to sleep. He had to get up. And this happened to him again over the span of a month, every single day. Every day it woke him very early, and he would say, how is the sun going to set now? And how will I keep vigil all night now without having rested? And of course, it was only natural that sleep would weigh on him so that he could not feel at ease in prayer. And he labored greatly every day, and because he leaned on the fact that the grace of God was sustaining him in a special way, he had by now grown weary in soul. Toward the end of the month, the devil roused him again, as he usually did, and as soon as he looked at his clock, just after he had fallen asleep, it woke him, and he stayed up until sunrise all night long. His patient endurance had broken, it seems, and somewhat vexed, he went outside and saw the sun already high, and he was talking to himself, and says, but my God, is this devil now going to conquer even a man's free resolve? After this, what is left for him to struggle with? With what strength will he struggle? And just as he spoke these words, he hears a sweet voice saying to him, for the sake of my love, will you not endure all of this? The elder, of course, understood where this voice was coming from. Again, alone, he cried out and said, yes, Lord, for the sake of your love, I will endure patiently. And he fell down and poured out abundant tears, many tears, and his soul was filled with the peace of God, and the temptation came to an end. He would tell me, in my great temptations, my child, I came to know the grace of God very tangibly. Because in proportion to the temptation that someone endures for the love of God, God responds in kind. And when a person labors at this with a very good disposition, and some temptation comes upon him, it is not possible for God to let him be tempted beyond what he can bear, and the recompense from God will certainly be substantial. Abba Isaac the Syrian tells us this as well. When someone is going through a great trial and struggling, and his patience breaks, and he begs God to take the trial away, and his prayer is heard, and God does remove it, that person must understand that, in proportion to the greatness of the trial, he has deprived himself of a corresponding measure of grace. It is as though he were saying, "Do you want to come to know the grace of God deeply? Be patient in trials, with faith and trust in God, that you will not be made to struggle beyond the strength of your soul. So hold your ground, and God will reveal himself." Once the elder had a great sorrow, which he did not describe to me, that is, a great temptation of his. It was surely something outward, coming from another person, and he suffered very much in his soul. He took refuge in the church, went to his stall, and fervently entreated the Mother of God, whom he loved with particular devotion, asking her to help him in the trial he was enduring. As he was making his intense prayer there, standing at the stall, leaning against it, before the icon screen, before the Most Holy Theotokos, without, of course, feeling it, as usually happens, without realizing that his bodily eyes had closed and the eyes of his soul had opened, before him he sees the Most Holy Theotokos, as though she had stepped out of the iconostasis and appeared before him alive, holding the little Christ child in her arms. She says to him, "My child, do not be troubled. I will help you." And the elder says, "Then I see Christ stretching out his little hand and gently caressing my face." My soul, of course, was filled with boundless joy, love, and longing for God. All my distress vanished, and the matter was resolved very well. Through various events and stories, he tried to instill deeply within us the remembrance of our departure from this life, the remembrance of death, so that we might continually dwell on these things in spiritual meditation. In this way, he sought to awaken and refine our conscience, so that we could examine ourselves more carefully. For the elder, nearly every night, and for the most part every day, always examined himself, held himself to account where he had erred, which passion still lived in him, and at what intensity, and he would take a corresponding resolve and struggle, by the grace of God, to be freed of it. And he told us to do the same. After we had grown tired from prayer, for a rest from prayer, there should also be study and spiritual contemplation, theoria, and after the theoria, once the nous had grown somewhat weary, to return again to noetic prayer. During the time of theoria, always to reflect and examine yourselves, where exactly you are erring, and to resolve to correct whatever needs correcting. And to help us, of course, he would bring before us, he would recount various events, first of all that of Ioannikios, and so many others about nuns and Athenite fathers, as he had also told us about Elder Ephraim, his own elder, that when the elder came to his last moments, he asked the elder like a beginner, "Elder, do you have no hope? Do you not feel within you such assurance that you will be saved, that you will go to be near Christ in the blessedness of God? I, my child, think that all my own people will go to the right hand of Christ."
"And I will go to the left," he says.
"But why do you speak this way?
Did you not struggle? Did you not toil? Did you not do so many things here? And how can you say that you will go?"
He would only answer that everyone else would be raised up, and he himself came second. He told us again that God arranges the person around the end of his life in such a way that he does not grow overconfident, so the devil cannot find some empty place there and slip in and plant logosmoi, intrusive thoughts, prides, and vainglories, and in the final moments win the person over. In the matter of the vigil, we would of course celebrate the divine liturgy. In obedience, in discipline, in the spiritual struggle, he was very strict. Where he was lenient and open-handed was in the matter of food, of eating. He did not restrict us too severely, because, of course, we had a great deal of hard work, both in our daily tasks and in our other labors. He would say, "If we do not eat reasonably well, we will not be able to manage." And because he was somewhat opposed to doctors and did not want medical treatments and such things, he tried to make allowances for us,
yet with himself he was quite strict. But with us, he was very open-handed indeed. What I mean is, he imposed discipline on us with great strictness. For when he would lie down to sleep, we had agreed one day, afternoon, after the meal, that we would sleep a little so as to rise again. Someone knocked at the outer door, which was some distance away. The three fathers had their cells over there, near the entrance, while I was farther inside with the elder. The elder called out and said, "Whoever it is, do not let him come this way, because we need to rest so that we can keep vigil tonight and stand before God. Above all else is to stand right before God, as if to say, I will not allow this man to come in for conversation. Because we are going to rest and rise with an undistracted mind, a rested mind, to give ourselves to prayer, so that our nous, the spiritual intellect, may stand pure before God." He was very careful about this, that there be no chatter, no discussions. We should avoid conversations, so that the devil may find no opportunity to distract our minds and cause us to pass the night unprofitably. He often spoke to us about certain cenobitic monasteries and certain abbots for whom he had great reverence, such as Gregory. He also deeply revered Elder Athanasios and held him in very high esteem, for he lived a holy life. Father Kodratos of Karakalu, Elder Filaretos of Konstamonitu, and other spiritual fathers. This is why order must always be guarded, so that there may be a good rhythm throughout the whole life of the brotherhood. Just as we kept that order there here too, as a cenobitic community, it has its own order, and we must struggle upon that order to keep it, in a sense, with exactness. When the hour comes for private prayer, let us rise and begin our private prayer, our rule of prayer, our own prayer, our theoria, the divine contemplation, our study, however many hours these may be, and let us struggle not to be overcome by sleep, but to use them spiritually, with effort, and without fail, we will feel great spiritual strength within our soul. It is not possible for someone to struggle spiritually and rightly, and not find grace from his God. That is out of the question, as in the reading we heard here the day before yesterday, from the Gerontikon, where a certain idolater priest asked a monk, "In your prayer," he said, "do you see anything? Does God reveal himself to you? Does he show you mysteries?" The monk said, "No," and he replied, "If they show you nothing, it seems you must be harboring shameful logismoi, shameful intrusive thoughts." "We," he said, "when we pray to our own God, he shows us himself," meaning demonic things. So it is here as well. It is not possible for us to pray as rightly and as patristically as we can in the way we have been taught and not find corresponding grace from God. Unless, of course, we are not praying properly and as we ought. Naturally, in the beginner stage, one cannot understand many things, yet even so, God reveals himself. In these hours, let us take soundings of ourselves in private. But when the hour comes for us to go down to the church, and the typikon calls us with the semantron and the bells to go down, then we must, and we are bound, to go down to the church, and all together, in common, to pray there, and to lift up to God whatever we have made ready. For within the church, too, the grace of God is abundant when one is receptive to know this grace. In the church, the mysteries take place. The holy iconography surrounds us there and clothes us, as with a sacred garment. Like a garment, it surrounds us, warms us, and refreshes us. We see the saints, and that is why they have been depicted in icons, so that we may look upon them and strive to imitate them. There is also a spiritual struggle there. Sleep will assail us, as will various logismoi, intrusive thoughts. There is exertion in standing and remaining at our places in the church. Yet none of this effort is lost or made in vain. It is never in vain. God receives him. Here, even a single glass of water given to a thirsty man earns a corresponding reward. How much more the one who sits for whole hours? And there is a beauty in the church when all the fathers are down there together, and one draws courage from another. But when the church is empty, there is a kind of deadness, a coldness, a kind of despair, that it is not easy, and so on, it gives no courage. As we see in a vision I once heard of, no, not a vision, St. Macarius, Macarius the Great, when he was once walking in the desert and saw a skull, and struck it with his little staff, and asked, "Who are you? Who are you?" and so on. The skull answers and says, I was a priest of the idols, and now I am in hell, down below, in the darkness that can be felt, it says, but you, Makarios, the servant of God, and the rest, your prayers reach even down to us there in Hades, it says. And we receive help. The saint was astonished and said, that may be so for Christians, but what help can you idolaters receive from a monk? Yes, the skull replied, your prayer casts a little light, and we can see one another from behind. For us, simply being able to see the others is a consolation. And the saint was deeply grieved, and he said, if this is what rest and consolation amount to, merely to see another soul down there beside you, so too here among us, when many are together, a certain comfort arises, a certain courage is born. Perhaps my own prayer falls flat, but my brother beside me may be more awake, his prayer stronger. Perhaps some temptation is warring against me, yet by his grace, the angel who stands near him will drive off the temptation that is mine. A brother helped by his brother is like a fortified city. Likewise, when the Samantron sounds for our work, let us go to our work. When it sounds for the refectory, let us go to the refectory. What I mean is that, as far as possible, we must observe the order of the monastery here, the order handed down by the fathers, so that peace may prevail among us. For a weaker person will be scandalized when he sees a brother acting in a disorderly way, and this becomes a stumbling block to the infirm brother, which is not permitted by the law of God. When many of us were living with the elder, we kept the monastery's order and became thoroughly accustomed to it. Even when it was still daytime, we would lie down to sleep, yet we kept the appointed order. Of course, we found it difficult at first, but afterward we became used to it. So it is with every monastic rule. One becomes accustomed to it when one makes an effort. And now the season has come again, when many people will visit us to be edified at the monastery, to see the monastic life up close, to draw near to it, to see living examples of it. We must be all the more careful in everything we do, so as not to cause any harm. For whoever benefits his neighbor most certainly draws down the grace of God. And now, during this brief absence, I will be making, as I usually do, I beg you to conduct yourselves among one another with even greater care, so that no temptation may arise. When we take care to humble ourselves, we will most certainly live in safety. Humility does not let a person stray from the right road of salvation. The one who does us the whole of our harm, the general harm, to each of us singly and to all of us together, is egoism. From here begin all sins, all faults in a person. We must pay very close attention to the matter of selfishness. Let us not constantly indulge ourselves, so that little by little we may open the way for the grace of humility to visit us. It is the most beautiful virtue, for the humble person, wherever he stands, will always carry upon him a beauty, a fragrance. What good is it for a thing to have an impressive outward appearance when it has no sweet fragrance within it? Abba Isaac, the Syrian, speaks very beautifully about humility. Let us hate from our very soul all contradiction and quarreling. It is utterly unbecoming for the one under obedience to contradict, to quarrel, for this reveals insubordination. The devil, of course, with much cunning, brings us to it so skillfully that we do not perceive him, and we make ourselves his allies. And we imagine that when we say something by way of self-justification and contradiction, it is nothing serious, but simply something right that needs to be said. Yet in reality, it is wrong. Let us not neglect our duties, because, as Isaac says elsewhere, God will not ask us how many prayer ropes we have completed, or how many prostrations we have made. But by failing to fulfill these duties, we gave the devil room to ensnare us in one sin or another. For the spiritual duties create safety. When a person fulfills his duties and, being human, makes a mistake somewhere along the way, the grace that comes through faithfully carrying out those duties brings him back again. Negligence is a very great evil. It does great harm to a person's soul. And even in worldly life, negligence in a layman will surely reduce him to poverty, reduce him to a beggar, for as long as he refuses to work, he will have nothing to earn to live on, and he will certainly be forced to ask others for help. How much more so spiritually here in this life of ours, where we have the devil constantly set against us? He confronts us face to face, watching us at every moment. He stands before us, looks us directly in the face, and continually plants logismoi, intrusive thoughts, in us. Because of his vast experience, he can tell how deeply these thoughts have taken root within us. Another matter we always emphasize is that of fantasies. He works especially through the imagination. May God give us the strength to drive these fantasies away. There is no passion. A passion has no strength without a corresponding image in the imagination. And from there, the passion and the devil do the whole work, the whole undermining of the person. The imagination is the greatest problem. If we pay attention here and struggle to drive away the sinful images, holding fast to the Jesus prayer, we achieve the finest success of all. The success of the age to come. No passion and no sin can stand in a person any longer, once he becomes master of his imagination. This is a great work, and all the neptic labor of watchfulness aims at just this, to cleanse the imaginative part of the soul. If we devote all our effort to this, then with a little labor, everything will fall into place. But if we neglect this, and try to wage the struggle elsewhere, we will not achieve much. The imagination will reduce everything to ashes. When we hold fast to the Jesus prayer, and maintain unceasing watchfulness over the imagination, we will at last be walking on solid ground. We will be following the surest path, the path of the fathers, the path toward apatheia, freedom from the passions, and toward the attainment of eternal blessedness. And when we live a watchful life, our imagination will not have so much fuel. It will not have so much material with which to raise a hard struggle against us in our striving. Let us be attentive in everything, and keep ourselves in the spirit of the struggle. Above all, let us humble ourselves, continually seek God's mind in our prayer, and keep knocking at the door of the divine mercy. And let us ask persistently, like the widow in the gospel, that woman who kept asking for justice against her adversary. That is, let us ask for the forgiveness of our sins, for this is absolutely fundamental. It is essential, because unless God forgives us, we will not pass successfully into the life to come. And whoever continually asks God for forgiveness will certainly ask with humility. This earnest seeking of forgiveness will help that person to live more watchfully and to succeed in this whole spiritual struggle. He will see the fruit of that effort at the hour of death, at that first judgment. He will immediately see the sum, so to speak, of his entire endeavor, his spiritual struggle, his reward, and his labors. There he will see the help he will receive from the angels. The angels will take their stand upon every spiritual struggle that the person undertook.
A person.
Let us walk with hope. Never allow yourselves the spirit of despair. Despair is something wholly demonic. God never, in whatever condition a person may find himself, however low and fallen, permits or gives or has any despair to give. For God is always hope, joy, relief, and courage. The approach of the devil is despair, desperation, fear, and all that follows. So it is to this realm of hope that we must give ourselves. Let us always hope that God will be our helper, and that even in our falls he will always be there to help. Of course he will not be seen, but through various circumstances he will reveal himself again. As we know of a certain ascetic, an anchorite, who fell into two deadly sins. He despaired, of course, and gave himself over to the world in utter desperation. Yet even so, God did not abandon him. God led him to a monastery to spend the night. There he appeared to the abbot and revealed this man's condition to him. The abbot drew close to the man and stayed with him despite the man's reluctance, helping and guiding him until his death. And afterward, this monk, this hermit, returned to his former good spiritual state, to the holiness he had known before. So even in such terrible, deadly sins, once again the hand and the providence of God follow the person. But Satan, being the very great craftsman that he is, begins to counsel him wickedly and says, "There is no salvation for you any longer. It is finished. Hope for nothing after a state such as the one you are in." And in this way he tries to block the mercy and providence of God, so that the person will not meet it and not be helped. This is why, when you see people despairing over anything at all, know that temptation is right beside you. We must push it away and say, "Whatever I am, I belong to God. Whatever I am, even in this worst of states, even if I sink to it, I will never let go of my hope in God." To hope is something. To despair is defeat outright. and therefore, it is always to our benefit to hold fast to hope.